Hello and welcome to AFAL Podcasts, the home of objective, up-to-date and independent reporting on Turkey. Don't forget to follow our reports through social media on afalnews.com or through our mobile app. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm AFAL editor David Lepeska, and with me today is David Roberts, lecturer at King's College London and author of Qatar, Securing the Global Ambitions of a City-State. Hello, David, and thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Pleasure to be here.
We are talking on Tuesday, November 12th. In the past week or two, relations between Turkey and Qatar have come under assault, at least in Turkey's pro-government media, which slammed Qatar's Al Jazeera for its coverage of Ankara's offensive in northeast Syria. But you see this as a non-issue, you told me last week, because Al Jazeera tends to make its own editorial decisions and because Turkey-Qatar relations are so strong. And in fact, just 2 weeks before, Doha had expressed official support for Turkey's incursion. If we could, let's turn back the clock a little for my first question. Tell me, how did this Turkey-Qatar alliance begin? It was in the early days of the Arab Spring, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we can go back a century or more, to be honest. I mean, the Turks, the Ottomans had boots on the ground in Doha for many decades, so back in the day. But you're absolutely right, this kind of latest iteration that we're kind of in at the moment of, as a quote unquote, unusually close relations between Turkey and Qatar kind of kicked off with the Arab Spring. And it was, broadly speaking, a certain meeting of minds between the two states in how to approach politics in the Middle East, really.
How so?
Well, in the sense that, I mean, you know, there are no sort of grand conspiracy here and there are no kind of, it's all fairly kind of straightforward. I mean, we'll come on to kind of, as in your introduction, this the chat more recently about how there's been a falling out. And I take a very laid back view to all of these kinds of issues and just go for Occam's razor, you know, that the most plausible kind of explanation is the likeliest. And so the punchline is, I think, when it comes to Qatar and Turkey, that they are relatively peas in a pod, as it were. They look at politics in the Middle East and the Arab world, and they both are quite comfortable, to varying degrees, engaging with political actors on the Islamist spectrum, with actors where Islam plays a prominent role in their ideology. Turkey, far more so, perhaps. But Qatar is... I'm using my language carefully here. Qatar is fine, had no problems with those actors. And the reason I say that is that Qatar is fine and has no issues with those actors. But Qatar is not some kind of slavish supporter of these kind of Islamist forces as it is portrayed. Now, Qatar has had and continues to have a huge amount of interaction with various groups in the Middle East and Arab world, including those on the Islamist spectrum. So I'm not trying to sort of deny the reality here, but I'm trying to sort of reframe it slightly from Qatar sort of cravenly, desperately trying to support these groups, as opposed to what I think it is, which is Qatar, you know, accepting that these groups are a fact on the ground, as it were. And yeah, sure, we need to engage with them. It has no problem supporting their causes on occasion. I think that's the kind of subtle kind of framing that we need.
Right. And many have said that what brought Turkey and Qatar together during those days, 2011, 2012, was their affinity for Islamist groups, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood. And many have said that Qatar's policy for years was influenced by Muslim Brotherhood figures, particularly Yusuf al-Qaradawi, Muslim Brotherhood spiritual leader. But you seem to be arguing that that was never really the case, that the Muslim Brotherhood influence was always or has long been overstated. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much, I think. I mean, Qatar's a really small place. You know, it's the size of Chemnitz. It's the size of Wolverhampton in the UK. It's the size of, you know, Plano in Texas. It's this really small place. And the levers of power are controlled by a few people and a few people only. There is no clergy. There is no kind of ulama to kind of structurally influence policy like we have seen for decades and decades in Saudi Arabia until more recent times. And so Qatar, like all of the Gulf monarchies, had a massive influx of exiles from the Muslim Brotherhood in the latter half of the 20th century. I mean, this is the UAE, this is Kuwait, this is Saudi, this is the entire Gulf. These individuals were persona non grata in Egypt, Syria, Iraq, as they had their own sort of nationalist ideas, as it were, and they were kicked out. And Qaradawi is a perfect example. These individuals came to the Gulf. Their expertise was needed in building these states. I mean that in a fairly literal kind of way. They came with an educated background from these far more, from at least the older, as it were, developed states. And they came with their knowledge of what a ministry is, how a ministry runs, how the functionaries of a ministry, any given ministry, how they operate. And they built the states. This is not even slightly controversial history. This is quite obvious history of the Gulf monarchies. And so without doubt, Qatar, like the other monarchies, has had these exiled members of the Muslim Brotherhood floating around for a very long time. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But when it comes to influencing in a meaningful way the monarchies and their policy, or Qatar and its policy, I'm not so sure, to be honest. I don't see an enormous amount of influence there. I mean, someone like Qaradawi had lots of sort of indirect influence. He's been a fixture on Qatari TV for much of the latter few decades of the 20th century, first on domestic Qatari television and then on Al Jazeera, of course, where his profile massively expanded. And so again, I'm not trying to sort of underplay his importance, but some notion of him or the Muslim Brotherhood insidiously trying to influence Qatari policy, I've just never really seen that mechanism, to be honest. And as I've written on many, many occasions, my explanation for Qatar and its support of, its undoubted support and continued support of groups on various aspects of this Islamist spectrum, it's more pragmatism than it is ideological fervor. I mean, that's my punchline.
As you say, Qatar supports and at least accepts the presence of some Brotherhood and Islamist figures within its borders. Meanwhile, its Gulf neighbors have a different perspective. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have exiled essentially any Brotherhood members, Islamist members, jailed them, have labeled the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist group. And then this all ultimately led to the blockade led by Saudi Arabia placed on Qatar in mid-2017. And one of the demands made by the Saudi-led bloc at that time was that Doha cut its military ties with Turkey. Instead, though, the blockade strengthened ties between Ankara and Doha because Turkey came to the rescue.
Yeah, that's not, I wouldn't really disagree with any of that. I mean, it's quite interesting, this Turkish base that we're both kind of alluding to. And again, my framing of this is that what began far more as a Turkish training team, as it were, in a given sort of Qatari military base, very quickly became, as it were, quote unquote, a military base as soon as the politics kind of demanded it. I think that was the way it was. I'm not.
That, just to clarify, though, that did happen after the blockade.
Yeah, I mean, this is all a bit opaque, and to be honest, so I'm offering my sort of interpretation of this. But yeah, after the blockade, the point is that what was a relatively small, let's call it an installation, perhaps, I don't know, a military training facility, you know, the nomenclature changed, and it was amped up from this installation or whatever to this base, and it has grown subsequently. And within the first few days of the blockade, we certainly saw Turkish troops arriving very visibly, defense diplomacy at its finest, a bit of deterrence. I mean, no one talks about that, is to a small kind of degree, Article 5 being NATO, Article 5 being extended to the Gulf in another kind of a guise, perhaps, but that's a by the by. But yeah, so Qatar used this the close relations they'd had with Turkey for a very long time, and they leveraged them in that way. And Qatar definitely supported Turkey then. The other way around, Turkey definitely supported Qatar then.
Right. A year later, Qatar supported Turkey. Qatar returned the favor, bailing out the troubled Turkish economy with some $15 billion in investments, as well as a friendly $500 million luxury private jet for Erdogan. This kind of seemed to seal the kind of special relationship. I mean, also alongside this, Turkish-Qatari trade last year surged 80%. It almost seems like the two are codependents now, in part because they have so few other allies in the neighborhood. At this point, can Turkey and Qatar afford to offend one another?
That's a good question. The relations have been sort of kind of strength to strength for a long time now. And just to add in one other sort of interesting aspect of their relationships. Turkey provided a lot of sort of rhetorical support for Qatar, and then this more pragmatic show support with the military installation or base, however we want to talk about it. But we shouldn't forget one of the most important ways that Turkey provided support for Qatar was in Libya, was also in Syria in particular. Qatar is a very small country, as I mentioned, around 300,000 people. And Qatar, I mean, one of the central sort of issues that Qatar perennially faces in every walk of its kind of life, as it were, is that it struggles with human resources. It does not have enough people to go around and leads to leverage relationships wherever it can. And so Mogadishu as well, we could add to this, you know, Turkey became a pivotally important kind of foreign policy actor with and on behalf of Qatar, as I mentioned, in places like Somalia, Libya, and Turkey. You know, it was the Turks that had the foreign service apparatus, the knowledge, the know-how, and so on and so on and so on. And so the two of them worked kind of hand in glove in various of these kind of foreign fields, as it were.
Right. I was going to ask about that. So explain how, let's say in Libya, for instance, how are Doha and Ankara cooperating, and what is their broader mission besides just simply countering kind of the UAE, Egypt, Saudi Arabia bloc?
So that's an obvious and straightforward and a good question to ask, but it's one that's really difficult to answer. I don't really think, to be honest, that Qatar is doing all that much in Libya these days. I'm not really going to pretend I can tell you what Turkey is up to in Libya these days. But, I mean, this is actually a nice way to kind of flesh out some of the pragmatism that I was on about. So one of the key Qatari interlocutors in Libya was a chap called Ali al-Salabi, who is a former sort of quasi-Muslim Brotherhood member, who was exiled in Qatar in a very similar way to many, many individuals in recent decades have been exiled from their homelands, as it were.
And many of them are now in Turkey.
Yeah, absolutely. Far more in Turkey these days, I'm sure. But the central reason that Qatar, I'm going slightly off piece here, forgive me, but the central reason that Qatar supported and channeled support and money and finance and so on to Ali al-Salabi and onto his quote-unquote sort of Islamist connections is basically pragmatism. He was there in Qatar. I mean, that sounds like I'm being sort of overly reductionist or very simplistic, but I'm absolutely convinced that the fact that they kind of knew him, that he happened to be in Qatar, is pretty much more important than some grand ideological struggle. But coming to your question, I mean, obviously these two things worked at the same time. So he was this sort of random individual, a slightly random individual in Qatar. And so he was there and that was useful. But yes, I suppose Qatar and Turkey have no problems engaging with these groups on the Islamist spectrum. That's absolutely fair. And I suppose they think that they are legitimate in their own ways. Now, the question of legitimacy is a difficult one, and we need to be sort of, I don't think we can do a great big broad brush here. So I suspect my point is, I suspect that the reasons they support these different individuals is quite specific in quite specific locations.
So then what about Hamas, which is a U.S.-labeled terrorist group? And in fact, earlier this year, the U.S. sanctioned several Turkey-related entities for continued support of Hamas. I believe Doha still supports Hamas. Maybe you could confirm that. How does this impact its aim to play the role of regional mediator?
That's a good question. As to the best of my knowledge, all the open source information suggests that Qatar still has a very close relationship with Hamas, a funding relationship with Hamas has had for a very long time. And I mean, I would take my cues from the Israelis here, to be perfectly honest. And to sum up a complex sort of four-sided relationship here between Qatar, Hamas, Israelis, and the Americans, whomever else, maybe the Turks as well, I don't know. Basically, the Israelis are pretty content, pretty happy that Qatar has this relationship with Hamas, the Israelis could quite obviously stop Qatar sending any and all monies to Gaza if it wanted to. Israel could block this Qatari relationship any time it wanted to, because that's the nature of the geography there, of course. But it doesn't. The Israelis, you know, obviously enough, have a vast number of issues with Hamas, but they are the devil that you know, to be perfectly honest. They are a pragmatic, in some ways, a pragmatic group on the ground. And that they are have an engagement with the Qataris. The Israelis are, to the best of my knowledge, absolutely content with that.
With Qatar and Turkey supporting Hamas.
Well, the word supporting there is the difficult bit. So I'm sure the Israelis would love it if Hamas disappeared tomorrow. Of course they would. But I'm sure the Israelis do not want the support for Hamas to end tomorrow. Because if that does end, then what will happen in Gaza? Will a more peaceable group replace Hamas? Of course not. It'll be, I don't know, Islamic Jihad or an even worse group. I think that's the kind of logic that animates the Israelis when it comes to Qatar. And so this is why we need to have this slightly longer form conversations about this, because obviously enough, as you mentioned, the group is heavily sanctioned and for good reason quite a lot of the time. And we can disagree vehemently, immensely vehemently with what Hamas does. But in this morass that is the politics in Palestine and in Gaza, the key actors on the ground, I mean, at least when it comes to the Israelis, they're content with their relationship to go ahead.
What about you? You mentioned Syria. Are Turkey and Doha cooperating there at all? I know that in the past, Saudi and Emirati officials have met with and I think financed the Syrian Kurdish militia that Turkey is fighting now, the SDF or YPG. Is Doha at all involved in that these days?
These days, I would probably say no. I'm willing to be corrected about this at any stage. Qatar's sort of interaction in Syria was much stronger in sort of late 2011, heavily 2012. And far more recently, I just don't think Qatar has been particularly involved there. I mean, there's lots of stuff about back in the day, as it were, of Qatar being involved with Jabhat al-Nusra, which was sort of an unabashed al-Qaeda kind of affiliate. And I wrote about this for the BBC back in the day, again, harping on this pragmatic line. So if we can point to different artifacts of Qatar having some kind of relationship with this group, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is clearly a terrorist group, you know, the question is, why does Qatar have this relationship? Is it because the Qataris have this secret Muslim Brotherhood kind of instigated desire to support under the table, you know, these al-Qaeda kind of groups? And my point has always been, no, I mean, that's just not really the way it is. Qatar sees Jabhat al-Nusra, or saw Jabhat al-Nusra. Again, these relations, as far as I know, are pretty much finished now. And in fact, Jabhat al-Nusra has kind of evolved into
a different
group. But Jabhat was a fact on the ground. We can dislike it and we can hate it and everything else, but it was a significant fact on the ground back in the day. And so the Qataris took a fairly pragmatic line to it, that if the fundamental problem in Syria is Bashar and, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra, we don't particularly like them, but if we do engage with them, well, then maybe we can procure from them hostages, which they did by the dozen back in the day, and maybe we can persuade them to get rid of their al-Qaeda affiliation, which they did a few years afterwards. I mean, I think that is the kind of animating logic for Qatar's foreign policy as a general rule.
Yeah, I think the similar sentiments could be said about Turkey's relations with the group that Jabhat al-Nusra joined, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. You know, and they're engaging with them, and people question that, but I think it was just a fact on the ground. I mentioned at the outset possible troubles in this Turkey-Qatar alliance. Qatar has also involved itself in gas drilling off the southern coast of Cyprus, partnering with Exxon in 2017, which in effect was a partnership with Turkey's foe, the Republic of Cyprus. Could this at some point emerge as a sore spot, or could, as some analysts have said, I read, could Qatar help calm the waters for Turkey in the eastern Mediterranean?
That's a good question. It's a nice issue to think about. I mean, the logic works both ways. Of course it does. I would say at the moment that, you know, unless we see a resolution of the Gulf crisis in the next kind of 6 months, 9 months, a year or so, Qatar will still feel that an unusually close relationship with Turkey is really, really important, such that it would not jeopardize its Turkish relationship by exploring for gas in the locations that you note. You know, back in the day, in the 80s and the 90s, Qatar attempted to kind of potentially work with Iran, because Iran and Qatar share an enormous kind of a gas field. They wondered if, joint exploring of the field and that kind of an issue could be a path to quieting relations. And so I'm not saying there's institutional memory of those. I mean, those attempts didn't go anywhere in the end. But my point's not that there is institutional memory of those ideas. But, you know, it's a logical idea that maybe Qatar can use that example as a bridge. It can be a faithful friend of Turkey, bringing it to some kind of discussion, perhaps. And that strikes me as fairly plausible.
You mentioned Iran. Some analysts have been saying that this Qatar-Turkey alliance has in recent months brought in a third member, Iran, in part because all three have a common foe, Saudi Arabia. A year ago, the trio formed a joint working group to facilitate trade. Are they moving closer together and away from the anti-Iran alliance that the U.S. hopes to build?
So, I mean, when it comes to Qatar and Iran, Iranian relations, I mean, Qatar has long been sort of accused of having unusually close relations with Iran. And I've never really seen much behind that, to be perfectly honest. It is Dubai, of course. It is by far the most significant Gulf kind of city-state, as it were, engaging with Iran has been for a very long time. And, the fundamental tenor of the Qatari-Iranian relationship was summed up by a former Qatari foreign minister, Hamad bin Jassim al-Thani, who was quoted in an American WikiLeaks saying, you know, the dynamic for Qatar and Iran is they lie to us and we lie to them, which I think is all we need to kind of know there. And HBJ, as he's known, is no longer significantly in the Qatari kind of foreign policy milieu. But I think that sentiment kind of abounds still. And so I do not think that you will see Qatar, you know, breaking again this sort of the Gulf, the GCC approach to Iran. Now, Oman does reach out to Iran, but Oman tends to do that in a relatively quiet way. I mean, I hope, as it were, that the Qatari government does not sort of reach out to Iran and go for lots of these sort of ameliorating policies, because that will be taken extremely badly by its friends and fraternal allies in the Gulf, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And I doubt that the Qataris would be so bold as to find yet another way to antagonize the GCC states when they're already in the midst of this Gulf crisis.
Well, right, but I mean, that's sort of the point. You don't see the Saudi pressure, the U.S. pressure. The U.S. has sanctioned both Turkey and Iran, and it has talked about labeling the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist group, which would force some changes by Qatar. You don't see this pressure from Saudi, the U.S., and the West pushing these three countries closer together?
It might do, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were rhetorical moves here and there. I mean, as a sort of an analogy, I mean, in Doha, there's a building which is the head of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, which is this. They wanted it back in the day. They, the Qataris, the Iranians, and particularly the Russians, wanted this forum to be the gas equivalent of OPEC, so they could control gas prices and jack them up ultimately. But nothing ever came of it. So there's this building that kind of sits there with this multinational workforce that doesn't do a whole amount of stuff, to be honest. And so, you know, that's a rhetorical sign of Qatar. Well, so it's not rhetorical. There's a building and a small secretariat and so on. But that's a sign of Qatar trying to reach out a very sort of small olive branch of sorts to Russia and to Iran. And so I can absolutely imagine these kinds of slightly inconsequential policies being taken by the Qataris, reaching out, quote unquote, to Iran or to Turkey. But I expect, you know, as the phrase goes, Qatar knows where its bread is buttered. I mean, I think Qatar needs to focus very much on resolving the Gulf crisis. And I don't think, I would hope they are not cavalier enough to think that they can interminably, as it were, forever do without their Gulf allies, and really turn away from the GCC kind of monarchies towards a different regional grouping, say with Turkey and Iran. I don't think that would be very sensible for the Qataris, and that would be a really pointed move. And so I wouldn't really expect significant movement in that direction.
That leads me well into my last question for you. Former Turkish Foreign Minister Yashar Yakush said last week that the Qatar-Turkey alliance might not be long-lasting. He pointed out that Qatar's long-term interests are with its GCC neighbors, with its Gulf allies, and with Arab states beyond that, rather than Turkey. Would you agree?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, if he's pointing to enduring, you know, if geography is still important, which I do think it is, then Qatar's only land border is with Saudi Arabia, and it is penned in by maritime borders with the UAE and with Bahrain, of course. You know, familiar relation. I mean, we don't need to belabor all of the similarities between Qatar and the other GCC monarchies. And so, you know, I mean, the Gulf crisis.
But it seems to be doing just fine in the blockade, you know.
Yeah, this is almost a bit of a worry of mine in the sense that, yes, you're absolutely right. The Qataris have almost prospered during the Gulf blockade. They've done probably objectively the best out of all of the states involved, as in its economy has rebounded the quickest and so on. And that's just due to basic, as I said, demographics in Qatar, you know, its income versus its people. I mean, Qatar is by far the richest state on earth. And so it can afford these things. It really can. But I just hope that that doesn't engender the Gulf monarchies, engender the Qataris, forgive me, to forget where its natural affinity does kind of lie. The blockade is, you know, maybe Qatar has, you know, weathered it financially, but the wider social cost is really quite significant in terms of embittering relations among families, even spread across the Gulf monarchies and those kinds of issues. And so I would ultimately, you know, I think the geography will win out in the end, and Qatar will ultimately, I think the GCC states will ultimately come to realize that just how much they have in common, and that will overcome these smaller difficulties.
So Turkish officials should not expect that this unusually close relationship is going to continue for long.
Well, if I had to sort of, you know, I often think about the U.S. relationship in the Gulf, for example. My argument has long been that we have passed peak American engagement in the Gulf. In the, you know, the peak was like 1990, 1991, the liberation of Kuwait, and the war in the early 2000s. And we were on the downslope of the U.S. Gulf relations. But the downslope can take a really, really long time. I think that particular downslope in U.S. Gulf relations has decades in it, to be honest. And, you know, I can imagine, you know, we have seen such strikingly close Qatari-Turkish relations. And so we are at the peak, maybe slightly coming down from the peak. I mean, what more can you get than the deployment of troops in a time of crisis? I mean, normal kind of international relations doesn't ask for more than that. And so I think we'll descend, as it were, into probably very close relations for a very long time, that the Qataris will not forget the help that Turkey offered. And I've no doubt that we'll see a few examples in coming years of, you know, unusually large joint ventures, say, or unusually large strategic initiatives between the two. But, you know, maybe they'll kind of plateau for a while, and indeed, maybe geography will ultimately win out.
Okay. David Roberts of King's College London, thank you so much for your time and insight.